Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Kildare's KFM.
The rate of third level students dropping out after just 1 year on their course has fallen yet again, according to new figures and new research from the Higher Education Authority. Senior Manager in Statistics with the organisation is Janice Lau. Good morning, Janice.
Good morning, Clem. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome to the programme. Now, that's something, of course, that seems to be quite a reversal of what we were hearing in recent times. What did you examine and what are the headline figures you're discovering?
Yeah, so the HA published a report on the analysis of non-progression rates in Irish higher education institutions yesterday morning. And so this looks at the progression of first years into the following academic year, with the most recent year looking at the progression of the 2019-20 cohort into 2020-21. And so this analysis looks across a myriad of student characteristics. So, for example, gender, age, field of study, your socioeconomic background, and prior educational attainment. So, for example, your leaving certificate points. So what we do is we track whether a student is present in 1 year in the first year of their study and whether they are still present in the following academic year. So if a student is not present in the following academic year, then they are considered to not have progressed. So overall, what we see is that there has been a downward trend from around 16% non-progression in 2010-11 to 12% in 2018-19 and now to 9% in 2019-20.
Now, we know that in the last couple of years of the pandemic, we had quite a bit of people dropping in, dropping out because of the disruption to the educational scene. But back, if you like, in the decade overall, where 16% of students did not carry on beyond their first year, of course, would indicate that very often maybe there might be clearer career guidance provided in schools. I know there can be a multiplicity of reasons for it, and I know your role as such is to examine the statistics. You don't offer reasons as to why this downward trend is continuing, do you?
Yeah, so the report is purely statistical, purely numerical, as you've said. So it is purely quantitative. And we do look at the non-progression rates, and we have been tracking these from around 2010, so a long time ago. And we look at various student characteristics, so gender, age, and so on. But we don't look at the qualitative elements. So, for example, motivational factors or psychological factors or financial factors. Mm-hmm. So it is purely quantitative, and it is a purely quantitative report. And it would be really interesting to see more research and more years of data, really, to determine a long-term trend. And
yeah, I would feel from both personal experience and indeed professional experience that possibly part of it is that students are becoming more informed in terms as they go through second-level schools. Career guidance might be that bit better. It might be that bit more inclusive, because I know, for example, that in terms of I should have my phone and silent there, and don't have it on silent, unfortunately, but these things happen on live radio. I forgot, but I would imagine that in the past students would have an idealistic view of a course, think they want to do it, and then they go into it again and find it's not what they thought it might be. Where are the lowest progression rates that you're finding, in what areas?
So some of the lowest progression rates, so we see
non-progression rates, I should say. Yeah.
So the highest non-progression, the highest dropout rate. So we see that services, for example, the field of studies, so students studying services tend to have a really high non-progression rate. So that's 16%, and that's followed by ICTs at 15%. When we look at different leaving cert points, you really see that those getting around 150 to 199 points have a dropout rate of around 31%, which is really high, of course, in comparison to the other leaving certificate points. And then as well, what we see is that males tend to have a higher non-progression rate than females. So it's 11% versus 7%.
Okay. And the areas of courses that we were talking about, I noticed there that, for example, there's courses like beauty courses are mentioned in regards to that, maybe some hospitality as well. Hair and beauty, hospitality, defence, or hygiene.
Yeah, so those are all within services. So the overall services, which you see, has dropped from 22% to 16%. So there is actually quite a large improvement, but it is still the field of study with the highest non-progression rate in comparison to the other fields of study.
Yeah, I see education with the lowest non-progression rate. Only 3% of students are not progressing past far year. And that higher non-progression rate than females at 11% for men, 7% for women. What about mature students then? People who maybe enter education or maybe change direction at later stages in their life. How are they getting on?
Yeah, so that's actually really interesting. So for students under the age of 23, and this is the age at entry, then the non-progression rate is 9%. And for mature entrants, which we are defining as age 23 plus, then the non-progression rate is 13%. So it's a 4 percentage point difference. So they are more likely to not progress. And so that's really interesting. But you do have to take that in light of all of the other factors that we are looking at as well. For example, leaving cert points or socioeconomic background, for example.
Right. And in regards to that, we're talking about, for example, level 6, level 7 and level 8 course. We're told there's no difference amongst the age groups at level 7. Students entering level 8 courses through various schemes have slightly better than average non-progression rates. But students entering from other non-traditional routes rather than the leaving cert points tend to have higher than average rates of non-progression across all levels. That's an interesting statistic.
It is very interesting. So if you look at the different entry bases, so we know that around 75% of our new entrants in 2019-20 enter through our second level school leaving exams, which would be your leaving cert, for example. And what you see is that students entering through access or foundation courses have the highest non-progression rate out of all of the different entry bases. So it's 15%. And then in contrast, what you see is that DARE, students entering through DARE schemes have relatively low non-progression rates. So it's at 7%.
Yeah, and one thing that takes my attention here is that first-year entrants with lower leaving certificate points have a much higher than average non-progression rates, particularly at level 6 and 7. I'm just wondering if that's because those with lower leaving certificate points have really less choice in terms of the course that they can access and end up maybe taking courses that might not even be their first or second or third choices, and leading to that dissatisfaction which then sees them drop out.
Well, what is really interesting is that if you look at our logistic regression models and you look at the fields of studies, when we take into consideration leaving cert points, you see that the gap really narrows. And so, you know, even when we look at leaving cert points by socioeconomic background, for example, you see that the leaving cert points gap really still exists. So, you know, it was 31% versus 3%, and it dropped around 25% to 4%. But there is still a gap there that we see.
All right, in regards to that, those with less than 200 points have a predicted non-progression rate of 25%. It all points out, despite the more positive aspects of the study, that college dropout rates are continuing to decline, as just 9% of students do not progress beyond first year. Nevertheless, it indicates the importance of everybody being well informed before they undertake these courses, with those high dropout rates still amongst those under 200 points. And I'm absolutely pretty sure, based on my own experience, that that's to do with people just having to take what's left over in terms of courses that they get into, and not always what might have been their original choices. Anyway, that's an opinion. But thank you, Janice Lau, Senior Manager in Statistics at the Higher Education Authority, on those latest findings. Thanks for talking to us in Kildare today, this morning.
Thanks so much, Glenn.
All right, good morning to you. Keep your messages coming as they are coming in. And before we go to the break, congratulations again to Amy and Owen. I want to warn your listeners about a scam. Right, says Catherine. I received a WhatsApp message. Hi, ma'am. My phone has fallen into the sink. I have a temporary SIM card. We'll have it sorted by tomorrow, but I need to pay a bill today. I have funds, but it's essential I pay this bill today. It went on a bit. The message, warning bell, says Catherine, should have been ringing, but we do anything for our children. That's what they play on. It was a considerable amount. I transferred the money. Oh, no, Catherine, you didn't. Realised my mistake, contacted the bank immediately, have got my money back. Lucky you. thanks to swift work by the bank. Sorry to go on. I just want people to be aware these scammers will try anything. Catherine, I don't want to rain in your parade, but we have highlighted that exact message in the past with Gardaí from the Fraud Squad on here. So if anybody's getting a message saying, hi, from I'm your son, I'm your daughter, and would you drop money somewhere for me? Ignore it. Ignore it. Ring your son or daughter up separately or contact them away from that phone call. Anyone that calls you looking for money, hang up. And finally, congratulations to all the best. And that's from the caretaker Joe at Piper's Hill.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Kildare's KFM.
Yeah, keep your messages coming into us, 0833 97 97 97, text and WhatsApp. You can email studio@kfmradio.com or call us on 045 898 999. As we go to the meeting of the Athy Municipal District, which took place yesterday, and Fianna Fáil Councillor Brian Dooley is on the line. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Owen, and congratulations to yourself and Amy. Well done.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated, Brian. Listen, let's get to the motions that you brought forward then. And first of all, you wanted the council to resurface the road, or one of the roads, between Narramore and Crookstown. As you say, it's deteriorating and there are safety concerns.
Yeah, the L8015, Owen. So it's a road between Pikebridge, Narramore and Crookstown. And I suppose I've been receiving several representations over the last number of months about the deteriorating surface of the road, as well as a few other issues that have come a cropper. So I suppose the council have made a commitment that in it, they would put it as part of the work programme for 2023. But I'd be following up on that with our own engineers, because there are other issues there. We have herds of animals on the road and stuff like that. So it's deteriorating in regards that if you're out for a walk, a cycle, or even driving your car, it'll be destroyed on that road. So that's something that we have to follow up on with the engineer.
Okay, you're looking for the council to prepare a plan for the refurbishment of the pathway along the River Barrow, with surfacing works from the courthouse in Athy to the area where the Blue Way development starts and finishes.
Yeah, this is an issue that has come up over the last number of years, especially with the Blue Way. For the Blue Way, when it is finished, it will finish down just opposite the Tegrel there. So basically then from the Hurst Bridge in Athy right into the town, that area doesn't form part of the Blue Way. The area in question is obviously underneath Waterways Ireland look after that towpath. It's in their ownership. But in order for work to be carried out in regards to resurfacing, and there is quite a bit of resurfacing to be done, the council need to give permission to Waterways Ireland, because it's a special area of conservation. Basically what came out of it, out of need known, is the public realm team who are overseeing the Blue Way, they're going to invite Waterways Ireland into a meeting with ourselves in the council. We're going to try and format a plan that we can come along and resurface that, so the council will support Waterways Ireland in resurfacing that area, so that the footpath and the bridge, it'll be user-friendly for everybody, irrespective of when you're on a bike, you're walking, you're in a wheelchair pram, whatever the case may be, it'll be able to connect everyone back into the town of Athy.
And just finally then, Brian, this issue of dereliction and derelict premises is coming up all across the county. I know Councillor Bill Clear in Naas recently found that there were over 100 derelict buildings between Naas and Salins alone. You had a similar motion brought in, or a question, to the recent Athy meeting, wanting the council to confirm the amount of derelict premises that are on the site register in Athy.
Yeah, and we were given a very small number, to be honest, which I thought was going to be a lot bigger than six. We were told it was six businesses that were on the derelict site register. And I suppose when you go through the town, you can see the number of businesses that are just closed up on. It looks shocking. We know that there are plenty of grants available to people who want to start a business, people who want to come in and try it, whether it's a coffee shop or a hairdressing saloon or beauticians, whatever the case may be. There are people who want to try and open their business, but we're finding it very difficult to see who the owners of some of these premises are. And a few of them are actually owned by financial institutions, but that's neither here nor there. In order for us to try and get these premises turned back into businesses or even homes, we need to get them onto the derelict site register in order for the county to carry out to go through the proper legal process.
Yeah, and obviously you're just talking about Athy there, Brian, but there are so many other towns around, you know, the south of the county, the likes of Castledermot as well, that I'm thinking of, and then also in other MDs such as Monastrevin, Newbridge, yeah, etc., where there are derelict buildings that could be used for businesses or other enterprises as well, but interested to see.
It's all over. It's in every county in Ireland, unfortunately, Owen, and there's kind of a, I suppose people haven't chased it up in the last number of years, but I think there is an urgency now more than ever that we get these units turned either back into premises or turned into homes.
So, absolutely.
I think you're going to see it cropping up over the next 12 months more and more.
Okay, with those motions and issues brought forward to the recent Athy Municipal District meeting, that is Fianna Fáil Councillor Brian Dooley. Clem.
Thank you, Brian, for that, and good morning to you. Now, Owen, we need, lately we asked the council for a statement. Remind us what we asked them about.
Yeah, so you might remember, I think it was last week or the week before, we had Margaret O'Keefe on the programme. She's a listener in Newbridge, and she was out walking on the Garvin Road and also around the top of the town in Newbridge when she realised that some of the drains in the town had been packed full of tarmac following recent resurfacing works that were carried out on the road. She was concerned that if we were to have a heavy deluge of rain or, you know, poor weather conditions, that this would cause driver safety concerns and road safety issues. So we brought her on the programme, we got in touch with Kildare County Council, asked them if they were aware of the situation, how this had happened and what the plans were going forward. Now we've had a response from Kildare County Council to say that they are aware of the issue and that they're engaging with a third party to try and resolve this issue. I'd imagine that's the contractor that they're dealing with there in relation to it. But yeah, some of the images that we got sent into us, I mean, this wasn't a drain cover that was put over the drains while the works were being carried out. This appeared to be tarmac that was, you know, filling
up into
those
the
drains.
Shores, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So look, Kildare County Council are aware of it and they're going to follow up on it and they're engaging with that third party.
All right. Also today, by the way, to let you know, if you're up around the Hazelhatch Road in Selbridge, that repairs to a leak are being carried out today and supply to the area will be affected from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. today. That's according to Kildare County Council. And I see also, by the way, that the French ambassador is going to be around the place tomorrow, because we've had an email from Cathal Berry's office, Cathal Berry, Kildare South Independent TD, and the email says, just to inform you, the French ambassador to Ireland, Mr. Vincent Guérin, will be visiting Port Arlington and Kildare Town tomorrow, and the itinerary will include arriving at 10:30 at the French Quarter Cafe. I'm not sure, that must be in Port Arlington, I imagine. A tour of St. Paul's Church, yes it is. And then departing Port Arlington at 11:30, heading for Kildare Town for a French lunch at the National Stud at 1:15, and then at 3:30 the ambassador will depart the stud. Not sure if that's open to the public or anything. Cathal Berry's office, if they're listening to us, might let us know in regards to that. And just one other issue that we covered last week, Owen. We mentioned here two ambulance stories that we had, one from Newbridge and one from Athy, where in Newbridge, an elderly man with a suspected broken hip, it took 5 hours before an ambulance arrived, and in Athy there were bleeding cases where it took a serious bleeding case where it took, I think, over 4 hours for an ambulance to arrive. We were contacted by the Irish Independent yesterday in regards to both of those stories, and I understand they might be including an article by Owen Maloney later in today's decision as well.
Did you say 11 hours?
No. Sorry, did I?
Well, I'm just wondering, what was the...
No, one ambulance to Newbridge was 5 hours.
Wow.
And it turned out that the elderly person did have a broken hip.
Yeah.
And the other case was described as a bleeding case in Athy. If either of those listeners are listening to us again, they might WhatsApp us about the outcomes. And regarding the Athy one, off the top of my head, I think they called for an ambulance at around 10 o'clock and it arrived at 2:40 in the morning.
That's crazy, because, like, look, we we've covered this before, and you know, I know the issue is that when you call an ambulance, the ambulance can come from anywhere, can't it?
Yeah, we're not blaming now the ambulance paramedics or the ambulance drivers or whatever else. By the way, one of those ambulances, I'm not sure was it for the Athy one or the Newbridge one, had to come from Trim in County Meath.
Yeah.
There was no ambulance available in Kildare. A paramedic did get in touch with us and say that when they drop a person to hospital, sometimes they have to wait hours outside the hospital until the patient is signed off by a doctor in the hospital. So you can have ambulances parked outside hospitals, no fault of the drivers and paramedics, who cannot leave until the patient is signed off. And surely that's bureaucracy gone kind of mad in terms of the ambulance service in this country. Now, it's not the only thing of concern in the medical services of this country, because there's extreme concern being expressed, not just today or yesterday. This is going on for over a decade, this particular campaign, by junior doctors and non-consultant doctors who are now going to be balloted for industrial action. Let's find out more, because Dr. Owen Murphy is a NCHD committee member with the Irish Medical Organisation, and he joins us now because apparently these doctors are going to say enough is enough is enough. We need better working conditions. We need safer working conditions. And the HSE has been alerted by medics of the need to address what are called long-standing concerns on working conditions. All non-consultant hospital doctors reported working beyond their contracted hours. Dr. Owen Murphy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Owen.
And thank you for joining us. It's Clem here with you on this one. Now, Owen, just tell me, first of all, define that term and what it means to be a junior hospital doctor.
So, basically, a non-consultant hospital doctor is any doctor that is not on the specialist registrar for being a consultant or a fully qualified GP. So this includes the majority of doctors that staff hospitals. So it is pretty much, you know, every doctor you meet would probably be a junior doctor for the majority of the cases.
And are all doctors in that scenario that you've just painted, are they all training to be consultants?
Half of the non-consultant hospital doctors in Ireland are actually from abroad, so from places like Pakistan, Sudan, South Africa, and they actually find it quite difficult to get onto trainee positions. So they wouldn't all be training, and that is another issue that the junior doctors are bringing up, because so much of our cohort are essentially locked out of training roles, especially when we have such an issue with getting specialists and tackling waiting times.
All right. Now, 7,500 non-consultant hospital doctors in our system. That's 2/3 of the medical workforce.
Yeah, no, we are a huge cohort, and I think it's about time that we really did try and improve our conditions, because you stay an NCHD for quite a long time. It's not a very transient phase of your career. It can take up to 10 years, even longer in some cases, to go from qualifying from your medical school to becoming a consultant.
Now, just hold on that note for a moment, because our last item on the programme this morning is concerning another topic of which I'm sure you're familiar with. We won't discuss it now. It's the cost of graduates who are entering medical studies, having, you know, graduated in another discipline, and the costs of 16,000 plus a year. And now with Bank of Ireland announcing they're no longer going to provide loans, etc., etc., we're going to be talking about that. But in your case, with 7,500 non-consultant hospital doctors, what kind of hours are you working?
Oh, it would absolutely beggar belief of the, you know, the person on the street, and even my family, when I'm telling them some of the hours that we are expected to do. And if we don't do them, there's literally no one else to run the hospital. So, like, it wouldn't be uncommon to have 80, 90-hour weeks, 24-hour shifts, two or three of them in a week, and you'd also be expected to do your normal day job in between those shifts.
But surely that compromises. The question, by the way, I was going to ask you is about the length of training. I'll come back to that in a minute. Surely that compromises you and your colleagues' ability. If you're working, anyone who's ever stayed up for 24 hours and maybe even just watching the television knows how hard it is to stay awake. But somebody who is having their sleep disrupted and is still expected to perform a highly significant medical prognosis or procedure or whatever, does that not compromise patient safety as well as your own health and well-being?
Yeah, look, we've been blue in the face highlighting these concerns to the HSE, to our employer, to the government, that these working hours are not safe, that we need rest, we need adequate on-call provision, we need subsidised accommodation where doctors have to live in two places at once. It's a very common thing where if you're on a rotation for 3 months, but you're based in the city, you can't just leave your accommodation. You need to double rent. So there's a lot of issues that are facing junior doctors, but of course, working hours in excess of, you know, 24 hours in a shift is you can't deny that.
Let's talk about your health and welfare first. 96%, according to a survey carried out by your committee, 96% of non-consultant hospital doctors are required to work more than 48 hours per week. Long shifts, as you pointed out, are a problem. 40% having been required to work in excess of 24 hours in a single shift. And I understand anecdotally that even a 36-hour shift might not be unheard of.
Yeah, you can go even further than that. Try 48. There are some doctors that have to be in the entire weekend until Monday morning.
On call.
So, look, you might get a few quiet hours for between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m., but I don't count that as rest when you're holding on to a bleep that at a moment's notice can go off and you have to be somewhere within 2 minutes. You can't rest, you can't sleep in that scenario.
Surely this is contrary to employment law. I'm an employer here, and our staff in this radio station, for example, are entitled by statute to 15-minute breaks morning and afternoon. And work hours are tightly controlled and work conditions generally. Why does that not apply to doctors in our hospitals?
Well, I suppose the argument we made, if we didn't do the hours, if there was no one in the hospital, then, you know, there would be no cover.
But that's a resource problem then, is it not?
It is,
we don't have enough people.
We don't have enough. It is a capacity issue. We are seeing emigration again. It's been the same issue for the last decade. We have improved staffing levels, but there still is a massive brain drain. Even the international doctors that we bring in, the great doctors from Pakistan, Sudan, places like that, they leave Ireland. They can't get onto training, and you know that causes an issue as well. So we're really not doing enough to retain doctors, and that's what this is all about. We're seeking a commitment from the HSE and the government to proper, meaningful contractual review and reform. And look, this is the last thing any doctor wants to do, to be affecting services. But at the end of the day, we think this is definitely for the greater good, because unless these conditions are addressed, you will not be able to address the situation in the hospital. That is largely a capacity issue. And then, of course, with EWTD breaches, that's the European Working Time Directive, that's against the law. And as you see from the survey, nearly...
Yeah.
Universally.
Well, that's exactly my point. That, I mean, we're governed by it and we have to apply it. I'm just wondering why it's not done in our hospitals. I'll ask you one hard question, though, notwithstanding everything you've said, which I think is shocking and has implications for patient safety, and I'll just maybe finish up with that in a minute. But are you not taking it out then on the wrong people, i.e. the patients, if you decide to take industrial action, when really your ire and everybody's anger should be directed solely at the HSE and the government for lack of resources?
Yeah, like I said, nobody wants to be going on strike, but it's the only option left to us at this stage. We have engaged tirelessly with the HSE on a range of issues in addition to the European Working Time Directive. And I think you'll find, like with the nurses' strike, the public will be fully behind the junior doctors if we do choose to take industrial action against the HSE and the government for our working conditions.
If I might quote Dr. John Cannon, who is a member of your committee, indeed possibly the chairperson of your committee, I saw him on television last night, and I'll just quote what he says. He said that this is a crisis for patients and healthcare services. Patients are being seen by doctors who are exhausted, stressed and under pressure. At a time when we struggle to recruit desperately needed consultants, we're driving away the next generation, as you have said, Owen. On that point, patients being seen by doctors who are exhausted, stressed and under pressure. Huge implications for patient safety there.
Yes, no, of course, and every doctor, when they go into work, does their absolute utmost and acts in a professional manner. But when you are working these excessive hours, then you know it speaks for itself, and that's why we feel like the status quo is actually putting patients at risk. You know, the government's inaction and actions, and the HSE's management of the health service with staffing is actually affecting patient safety. And I think the public will definitely support our calls for industrial action. Of course, we were looking for a commitment from the HSE, and we want them to bring them to the table. So if we can avoid industrial action, well, we're all for that. But we have been engaging tirelessly with HSE and management, and a lot of times it's fallen on deaf ears. And so we are taking this very seriously, both for our members and for patients that would be affected, and we don't take this decision lightly, and we hope that people can get behind us, and we're going to try get our story out, and to get people aware of what sort of conditions that are expected of doctors today. And look, we'll try and make as much of a difference as we can, not just for ourselves, but for all the patients that use the health service.
I don't think you'll have any difficulty getting public sympathy and support for your cause if those conditions are permeating our hospitals. 96% of hospital doctors required to work more than 48 hours a week. Shifts of 24 hours, 36 hours, 48 hours. With all due respect to you, Dr. Owen Murphy, I wouldn't want to be seen by you if you have worked a 24-hour shift and been up all night. And I certainly wouldn't want to be seen by you if you've worked 36 or 48 hours. It's not safe for you and it's not safe for me. Those are appalling conditions indeed to work under. You'd have spent 5 years in college, would you? And then you're saying that you can spend up to 10 years working as a junior doctor before you might be offered a consultant's position?
Yeah, well, it depends on the route you take. A lot of people will, you know, do their intern year, and then they might travel abroad for a bit and then come back, and then they might need to decide what they want to do, and then they get onto a training scheme. And look, it definitely, the guts of 10 years, or you know, a decade, even longer. If you're not from Ireland or if not from the EU, it can take even longer. You can be even longer as a non-consultant hospital doctor, and that's another issue whereby we have so many great, talented doctors who have come from abroad and been working here for years, and they end up emigrating to the UK because they'll get training opportunities there.